Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves.
And I'm Don Bishop. We're your hosts for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Paul Mariner, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing for Atlantic salmon. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Paul your most important question. We'll receive your questions promptly, and we'll try to answer as many of the questions as possible on the show tonight.
This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 12 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form.
When we return, we'll be talking with Paul Mariner about fly fishing for Atlantic salmon.
New from the Winston Rod Company for 2007, Boron 2T Rods, New Technology, Traditional Feel. This series combines the feel of our traditional action rods with the lightness and responsiveness of our latest technology. These rods offer the ultimate in delicate presentation while still retaining a good measure of power and reserve thanks to the dynamic properties of our Boron 2 technology. These four-piece rods are available in 3 through 5 weight and retail for $625. They are designed and crafted at the Winston Shop in Twin Bridges, Montana, and feature the traditional Winston green finish and the Winston unconditional lifetime warranty. Cast the new Winston Boron 2T at the best place possible, your local specialty fly shop. Well, before we introduce Paul, tonight we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a copy of Paul Mariner's book, Stillwater Fly Fishing Tools and Tactics, published by Gales End Press. We'll also be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 3 chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Paul's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show.
Well, Roger, tonight's guest admits to a 40-plus year passion for Atlantic salmon. Paul Mariner is a native of Nova Scotia with a background in mechanical engineering, but fly fishing is his forte. His book, Atlantic Salmon, a Fly Fishing Primer, won an Outdoor Writers Award in 1994, and Modern Atlantic Salmon Flies won again in 2000. Paul owns and operates Gales End Press in Nova Scotia, and he is associate editor for the Canadian Fly Fisher magazine. He's field editor for both Outdoor Canada magazine and Eastern Fly Fishing, a fly tying columnist for Eastern Woods and Waters, and he has authored literally hundreds of articles on fly fishing and tying. In 1991, he received the Gregory Clark Award for outstanding contributions to the arts of fly fishing. Paul has authored the Miramichi River Journal and the Ausable River Journal, but he's by no means a one-dog pony show. He's fished fresh and saltwater species in a dozen countries around the world, and since 2003, 3 of his works have been published, including the books Stillwater Fly Fishing, Tools and Tactics, and in 2006, he co-authored A Compendium of Canadian Fly Patterns. In addition to his writing, Paul's a regular lecturer on fly fishing and fly tying. He's a 17-time member of the Canadian National Fly Fishing Team, served as captain several years, and competed in the Commonwealth and World Fly Fishing Championships numerous times. It's a real pleasure to welcome Paul Mariner, our second Canadian guest in a row to ask about fly fishing internet radio. Paul, thanks for joining us tonight.
Okay, Don. How are you this evening?
Terrific, terrific. I'm really excited to hear about Atlantic salmon. I've been dreaming about them since I was a kid, and that's many moons ago.
Do you want to say how many moons?
Yeah, several.
Several. Okay, we'll leave that as the secret for tonight. Well, Paul, welcome to the show. We've got lots of things we want to cover, and folks out there, talk a lot about the background of the Atlantic salmon, where they are, how they live, and how they move through their spawning process and so forth. We're going to talk a little bit about equipment to use and definitely about flies. A lot of questions tonight about flies. And also presentation strategy seems to be our biggest section of questions tonight. So I think, Paul, people want to get one on the hook for some reason. So we'll see if we can't help them out. And also near the end we'll talk about ethics and etiquette. Evidently there's a whole thing around the ethics and etiquette that we may not find in other parts of the world or other types of fishing. So that will be interesting to you, I'm sure. Well, let's get started, Paul. I think, is that mystique well-founded? First off, there is a mystique of sorts that has surrounded the Atlantic salmon. What's that all about?
Well, really, it has to do with the history behind fly fishing and fly fishing for salmon in particular. And one of the major contributors to that mystique is that it's expensive or it was difficult. And it, particularly when it came from the UK, from England and Scotland, that was not the sport that the ordinary fisherman got into. He was kept away from the salmon rivers. They were owned by the royalty, and they were not easily, so it was not easily obtainable. So there was a mystique about it. As well, the development of the flies, which we'll talk a little bit about later too, added to that because the flies were so outstandingly beautiful and used such rare and unusual feathers, for example.
Paul, we have a question from Kevin Brady in Coatesville, Pennsylvania. He wonders about the current range of Atlantic salmon, and I might just throw in, perhaps we could compare that if there's a difference in the historical range, which Bernard from Los Angeles, California sent in.
Well, the range has shrunk somewhat, particularly in the last 100 years or so, probably due to climate change, but one is never absolutely positive. There's some other contributors there. So it has moved north somewhat. So a number of the southern rivers, say both on the European continent, for example, Spain and France, and in North America, southern Nova Scotia and the northeastern United States, for example, the rivers are not nearly as abundant or, in some cases, do not even have Atlantic salmon anymore. So the range has moved a little bit north. But outside of that, really we're talking about the Atlantic, North Atlantic seaboard as the home range from Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Quebec, Newfoundland, Labrador, and then across to Iceland, a tiny bit in Greenland, but not very much, then across to the UK and Denmark, Scandinavia, and then into the Arctic with some of the Russian rivers and in the Kola Peninsula, for example. And that's pretty much the range of salmon today. And like I say, it's changed a little bit in the last 100 years, but still not that much.
Have there been restoration efforts that contributed to maintaining the current level of distribution?
There are certainly a lot of efforts. In fact, they span a lot of areas. For example, not just in the normal restoration processes that you would think of where people would work on the rivers or that there would be special regulations. All this is true, but a number of the, some of the biggest ones have been the buyout of commercial fishing, for example, off Greenland, where agreements have been made and in order to reduce the catch. And so it's a very unusual in that respect. It's an unusual way of helping to keep the population up. Certainly there have been other attempts to reintroduce salmon into areas that were killed off because of dams or other obstructions or other industries that would contribute to unhealthy rivers. but they have not been as successful in the southern areas. There's been some major attempts, but they haven't been terribly successful. They have been successful in some of the northern areas, as I mentioned, where the range is still quite extensive, and some of those rivers certainly have been restored by cleaning up, taking out dams, and removing pollutants and or polluters from the rivers.
Now, are the Atlantic salmon still commercially fished? Is that taking a great toll on it, or is that a controlled situation?
The major amount of commerce, well, I would say commercial fishing in North America really doesn't exist except for Aboriginal fisheries. There are a number, quite a few Aboriginal fisheries that still exist. There is some commercial fishing, as I mentioned, off of Greenland, which is where, we'll talk about it a little later, but that's where most of the larger salmon from the North American rivers go. There still is commercial fishing in Europe. The Faroes, for example, still have a major fishery. There's been some progress in reducing a very large fishery off of Ireland. That's been reduced within the last year, I believe, or 2 years. And there still is some river netting that goes on in some rivers, some other rivers in Europe. But outside of that, for example, the thing that is most, or the area that's most of concern to our listeners would be North America. And as I say, the commercial fishing, it doesn't really exist except for the Aboriginal fisheries.
So, I mean, there's hope for that, I think. You know, they're doing well with that up in Alaska. In fact, that's a very strong, you know, commercial fishery up there, but they've had to work hard and put in a lot of laws and so forth to, you know, to make that happen. But there's also the farming of Atlantic salmon that goes on. Now, is that happening up in your area?
Yes, it is, and it's a major concern in some respects. The one of the ironies is today that there are more Atlantic salmon in existence today than there have ever been in history. Unfortunately, probably 90% or more of those are in pens, so they don't really do. They're not really considered Atlantic salmon for those of us who want to fish them in rivers. As a result, some of these commercial operations where you're raising fish, farmed fish, can definitely impact in several major ways wild salmon. For example, they are transmissions, because you put so many fish, cram them in together into a pen, you have disease problems, and that can spread to wild fish that come into contact with those fish in one way or another, or the pens. And the other thing, another major concern is escapes, because these fish are shall we say, designer fish. They're designed and to grow fast and have certain characteristics. They may be more aggressive when it comes to trying to spawn in the river, and they will pass on not the right kind of characteristics for life in the wild, but the characteristics that have been bred into them by their quote-unquote makers. So commercial salmon fisheries, in that sense where they're being raised, pen-raised salmon, are not particularly helpful when it comes to, unless they're separated by considerable distances from any wild salmon rivers.
Yeah, and apparently some of this effort for farming Atlantic salmon is spreading to the west. Royce Van Blaercombe points out that Washington State, I guess, either has or is considering a venture in that regard. Do you have any opinions about that?
Well, certainly there's a considerable dismay at the at farms where you're, particularly where you're farming a non-native species, and there have been escapes. They have found Atlantic salmon that have begun to spawn in the wild in some BC rivers, and I believe also in some Washington rivers. Not many, but it indicates they at one time they felt, of course, that Atlantic salmon couldn't survive in the Pacific outside of their pens, but that proved to be false, just like in the east here, while they've never been particularly successful, there still are a few coho salmon that were planted hanging around in some of the rivers, and certainly steelhead have adapted to certain rivers in eastern North America into the salt water and that would therefore compete with Atlantic salmon. So it's never a good idea to introduce alien species into a river system or even into an area.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, we see examples of that same thing more than we'd like. Paul, could you give us a rundown maybe of some of the popular rivers in North America on the eastern seaboard and up into Canada that
sure.
you're referring to?
Sure. There's not much question that the most popular river in terms of visitors every year would be the Miramichi River system in New Brunswick. This is a huge system. It was at one time likely the most important Atlantic salmon river system in the world. It may now have slipped into second place behind the Tana River system in northern Norway. But in essence, this is a very large, covers thousands of square miles. The drainage has many tributaries, and as a result, because of the nature that it's not so far removed from civilization, it has been a sport fishery. It was a commercial fishery, of course, for many decades, and is now only a sport fishery, really. And as a result, it contributes probably more hours of Atlantic salmon fishing to the sport fishery than any other river on the continent. After that, you're looking at smaller rivers or rivers that have more, or should I say, have slightly restricted access in one way or another, and we can get into that a little deeper further on. But effectively, you have the rivers of the Gaspé in Quebec, which are very popular. Once again, they're reachable, and that's a fairly major consideration. There are the rivers of Labrador, which and Newfoundland, which are a little harder to get to, but they're still quite popular, as are a few of the rivers along the north shore of the St. Lawrence. However, once you get far, of course, the farther you get away from the major centers, the less these are visited, simply because of the distance involved and the difficulty in getting there.
Now, those are all Canadian. Is there any, and we have a question here from David Shatsko in New York City. And he wants to know, is there anywhere he can fish for Atlantic salmon without driving for hours and hours? It sounds like he's going to have to drive a few hours. So
well,
closest point?
Well, there is really almost no Atlantic salmon fishing in the normal sense in the U.S. anymore, in that there is a short fall season on the Penobscot that just started once again, that's in Maine. And that river has been under attempts to restore it for I would say several decades at least, if not more. And it has never been, unfortunately, terribly successful for the reasons that I mentioned at the beginning. The most southern rivers, or in that area in that southern range of the Atlantic salmon, which seems to be shrinking. So, but there is a short season there, but there's very few fish were caught last year, and I just checked today, and looks like there will be a season from the middle of September to the middle of October on the Penobscot again this year, but there's not a lot of fish going to be caught there. Now, his best chance to catch Atlantic salmon would be landlocked salmon that run out of Lake Champlain. Now, that's certainly not a difficult drive from New York City, but those fish are, although they're genetically no different than the Atlantic salmon that go to sea, landlocked Atlantic salmon rarely grow to the same sizes. So you would find mostly the smaller fish in the, say, in a 3 to a 6 pound range, and they run into rivers like the Saranac, for example, that runs into Lake Champlain. So there still is a fishery in those areas that you where you can fish for Atlantic salmon, and they do. But that's pretty much it within driving distance or easy driving distance, certainly, of New York City. And my best advice is to jump on I-95 and head north towards the Miramichi.
One more question before we take our first break here, Paul. You had mentioned Labrador as a more remote place to fish for Atlantic salmon. Is there truly wilderness areas that you can fly into and not be shoulder to shoulder for Atlantic salmon still?
Well, actually, that the concept of shoulder to shoulder, you don't even have to fly in, because we'll get into a lot more detail on that later, because the management of Atlantic salmon is very complicated, very, very complicated. And you can find wilderness fishing right in areas of the Miramichi, for example. You can take a canoe trip and fish on sections of the Miramichi River and be well removed from anybody. And oh yes, and but that, like I said, this can be a little complicated. So the answer to that is absolutely yes. You can certainly find lots of places to go where there isn't anybody else. But usually the distance that you're going to be from other people has something to do with how much money you're prepared to spend to put that distance between you and everyone else.
Of course, of course.
Well, let's take a brief break, and when we return, we'll be talking more with Paul Mariner about fly fishing for Atlantic salmon.
Mountain River Lanyard products are designed by Montana Fishing Guides. Be rugged and functional. Check out our newest product, the Double Haul. Here, the ordinary just got wild. This lightweight product was designed with the bone fisherman, steelheader, and the small stream fisherman in mind, anglers who carry a minimal amount of gear that needs to be handy at all times. The Double Haul is sturdily built and offers a padded neck and safety release, flip-down workbench with a ripple foam fly patch, and it gives you two spool pockets, a large accessory loop, and a secure pocket for pliers or hemostats. Most of these products can be found in your local shop. For more information, call Mountain River Lanyards at 307-734-3998 or visit our website at www.mountainriverlanyards.com. That's mountainriverlanyards.com.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Mariner about fly fishing for Atlantic salmon. If you'd like to send a question for Paul, go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Paul your most important question. We received your questions promptly, and we're trying to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Paul, before we move into the life cycle of Atlantic salmon, do you have any upcoming projects or books that are in the works?
Right. Probably the one that most interest to me and related to the show, of course, is that I'm starting to work on a new edition of my Atlantic salmon book that would update the methods and what I've learned in having fished probably at least another 100 rivers since for salmon since I wrote that book, the first edition.
Great.
Okay. And tell us about Gale's End Press, and you might want to give people the website for that.
Sure. That is, you've pretty much already given it. It is www.galesendpress.com. That's spelled GALESENDPRESS. And that's the site where I have, at this particular moment anyway, only my own books. And that will include, of course, the Compendium of Canadian Fly Patterns, which is the most recent one, which I co-authored with Bob Jones from the West. And so that has flies for both Atlantic salmon and steelhead, for example, trout, pike, bass, every species that, pretty much every species that we have in Canada and that we fly fish for. I'm sure that, I don't recall whether or not there's one in there for sea fish or not, but, but pretty much everything else, there's something in there that someone has designed to catch those fish.
Well, now, you're uniquely positioned to answer a question from Elmont Percy in Fergus, Ontario. He He's considering writing a book on fly tying and wonders if you have any tips or suggestions for a newcomer to the field of writing.
Well, I would say that the major tip I would provide someone is that that most people don't think about is the importance of photography. And before you start writing a book, you pretty much have to learn how to take the photographs to support it. So if you're looking to produce a book on how to tie flies or tying a particular type of fly or patterns or whatever, you're going to have to learn how to photograph either the flies or the steps in tying the flies. And so if you have good photographs, it then becomes fairly easy after that to get an audience either through magazines or in a book. So that's the biggest hurdle for most authors is the quality of their photographs.
That's a huge tip. Roger and I are quick to pounce on anybody who has the nerve to put out a book with less than excellent photography, and Roger's background as a professional photographer may have something to do with that. Well, Paul, let's move on. If we might, could you give us a rundown?
Don, before you do that, I'd like to comment on that. I'm sitting here looking at one of Paul's books, Modern Atlantic Salmon Flies, and the pictures are exquisite. There's great shots of the flies in there. So if a person wanted an example of good photography, that's one of Paul's books that they should pick up. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't you give us a rundown on the life cycle of the Atlantic salmon?
Okay, it'll take a moment or two, and
sure.
But I'll try and keep it tight. Let's begin with the laying of the eggs, shall we say? So eggs are essentially laid in November. Now you have to understand that throughout the world, in different places, the climates, et cetera, and geography will have something to do with the exact timing. But for all intents and purposes, it's a fall event and usually a late fall event. The eggs overwinter and hatch in the spring. From then on, we go from fry to par, which are like small trout, and they grow to a certain size. And it, once again, it depends on latitude, and it depends on the river system, the amount of food, how long they'll grow. It could be, in some cases, as short as 1 year. Normally, though, it's usually 2 to 3. However, in some places, it's as many as 6. If they're in, for example, in the far, far north, where it takes, they have a very short growing season, it could take them 6 years. But then in another spring event, that it happens about the time that the eggs are hatching, just probably a bit before that, the par change, the fully grown par, change over and become smolt. And what that means is they begin to change physiologically so that they can adapt to the salt water. Then they begin to swim downriver towards the salt water and changing all the time. They get silvery, so they look like little tiny salmon. And once they enter the salt water, they then, and now I'm going to speak specifically here about North America, and in particular, the southern rivers, and by that I mean Quebec, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and New Brunswick. The smolt will head for one of two places. In the first place, some of them will go to feeding areas off of Newfoundland, and they will return the following year. So they'll overwinter one winter feeding, and then they will come back the following spring, so about a year later. However, another portion of the population will continue on and go to the major feeding grounds off of Greenland. Now, they may spend anywhere from 2 to 4 years feeding off of Greenland, and they are still maiden fish. They have never yet spawned. So they'll come back after 2, 3, or 4. They're called 2, 3, or 4 sea winter fish, multi-sea winter fish, and they're big. And depending on how long they spent, 2, 3, or 4 years, depends on their size. Now, these are now the spawners. They're going to come back ranging anywhere from let's say from the end of May through till October, into October. Now these fish, once they've spawned, they will, and I noticed this is usually a question for people from the West Coast, the Atlantic salmon do not die after they spawn. Now, when I say do not, that's that we're talking about the major percentage. Some, of course, do because of the rigors of spawning, and it depends on their condition when they enter the river. But the vast majority of them do not. Some of these fish will leave, depending on the nature of the rivers, will leave right away and go right back to the salt again. Others will spend the winter and then come back down in the spring. This is before this. This is just after ice out. They'll leave the river, and it's a pretty difficult transition to go back after having spawned, having lost a lot of weight because they haven't been able to feed during the winter time. They then are plunked back in the salt water again. They have to make that adjustment. So a lot die when they get just from going back into the salt water. A lot more get because they're not as strong as they were on their way in. Seals pick off a bunch of them. However, some of these fish will head back, and some of them will feed off of the mouth of the river and come back in once again, perhaps that fall, so that they might go out in, say, excuse me, May, and then come right back in August. And there are numerous examples of fish that have done that. Others will go back to the feeding grounds and may come back a year later, and in some cases it might be a couple years. So once again, you have these multiple methods developed by evolution in order to protect the species against all kinds of disasters in their home rivers. So that is a rather long, but not really a capsule, explanation of the biology of the Atlantic salmon.
No, that's very good. Yeah. What's a grilse?
A grilse is a salmon that has returned after one winter at sea. So they generally are between, say, 3 to 6 pounds is the size. But the whole point is that they've gone out in the spring and come back one. They've only spent one winter feeding in the ocean.
And these, before they go to the ocean the first time, you said they're called pars, and then they move to a smolt stage.
Right.
Are those, do you ever catch those as fishing for trout or something?
Oh, you catch them fishing for salmon, too. Okay. One of the reasons that they've survived so well is that they're very aggressive, and they take flies very well. They feed, they're much bolder than trout usually are in terms of putting up with people and other things. They don't run for cover quite as quickly as a trout would. This, of course, can mean that they get eaten by mergansers, but it also means that they're quite aggressive in trying to grow. So you will catch them. The smolts, of course, you catch them a little less because that period of time where they're actually moving out of the rivers is before the main run of salmon come in, and also it's a fairly short period of time, so you won't catch a lot of smolt, but if you're fishing there during those periods for trout, for example, you will catch the smolt on the way out as well.
Well, I'm really surprised at the complexity and the variability of that life cycle. I suppose that's a genetically determined variable, is that correct, as far as the amounts of time that are spent?
Absolutely, and I barely touched on it. Actually, there are probably another dozen ways that I could get into that the species uses to protect itself from, like I said, natural disasters. And that's mostly what it is, of course, because those were all developed before man started to interfere with nature, particularly. But that they have many survival mechanisms that I haven't even discussed, but they become less and less important. They affect fewer and fewer percentages of the population.
Okay. Well, what season then is the best to fish for Atlantic salmon?
Well, that is a matter of choice. There are, you can fish for salmon starting with particularly on the Miramichi or in New Brunswick River, but it's particularly a Miramichi thing, and on the Restigouche, you can fish for kelts. Now, a lot of people aren't really happy about that, but it's actually an extremely conservative fishery. There's nothing wrong with it at all. I've explained what happens to the kelts on their way out. However, the water is very cold, and so the virtually 100% catch and release, and it's about 95% or more effective. So the fish survive very well from being caught. They release very well, and so it's a very conservative fishery. The other important thing about spring fishing is that the salmon are feeding. They're coming down river after having spent the winter under the ice, and they are quite aggressive, and they feed quite aggressively. And so your chances are very good of catching many more than you normally will during the bright season. But they've lost a lot of weight. So some people are not really happy with fishing them at that particular point in time. The summer fishing can be a little tougher, but the fish are at their prime at that particular point in time, particularly early in the run, which is the favored time to catch them as they're first coming into the rivers. They're at their strongest and prettiest, if you want to put it that way. On the other hand, if you fish in the fall, which is one of my favorite times, it not only is it a favorite time in terms of the salmon, because the salmon have been coming all throughout the season, so you really have, the rivers are now as full as they're ever going to be, and there are fresh fish coming right through into the fall, as well, of course, it's a beautiful time of year to fish. And so you put the two of those two things together, and for me, my preference really is to fish in September and October.
Paul, I'm sure this has changed over the past years, even in your lifetime probably. Talk about the size of the fish at the different stages. I mean, the ones that we're fishing for. I know a lot of the ocean fish themselves have dropped in size. But give us an idea today what size fish we might catch.
Well, actually there hasn't been that much change in Atlantic salmon. Probably in terms of the angler, the biggest change has been the removal of the commercial fishery, which targeted the larger fish. So although it's been a slow process, over the last 25 years or so, we've seen a gradual improvement in the numbers of large fish that are being caught.
Oh, terrific.
And I'm sorry?
I said terrific.
Yeah, oh, it is. Actually, it is. We don't see as many fish, but it's hard to balance that out. I know that for a fact that some of the large grilse runs that we used to have gotten smaller, but at the same time, as I said, we've got some more larger fish. The actual sizes, as I mentioned, grilse can run from say 3 to 6 pounds. The smallest grilse I think I've ever caught was probably a pound and a half, but the average is certainly from some 3 to 6 pounds. And then you start the next one sea winter fish runs usually from about 8 to 10 to 12 pounds. It depends on any number of factors. You start getting up into the 16 pound, and 3 you're up in the 20s, and then 4 you're probably into the 30s and 40s. But now this, when you start talking about fish of that size, there aren't very many of them. The bulk of the larger fish are going to run from about 8 to 18 pounds.
Okay. Well, that gives me a good idea. And then before we move on into equipment and so forth here, one last question before we take another break. How is the fishing for salmon in North America different than, say, Western Europe or the UK, where it's probably most popular?
Well, actually, of course, it is popular certainly in the UK. It's also very popular in Scandinavia too. Norway is a huge salmon destination. But primarily the differences are historic in some way. All the fishing in North America is with a fly. That's not true in Europe. You can fish with worms, for example. You can fish with spinners, spinning gear. not every river, not every place. And everything I say has caveats, so there are places where you have to only fish with a fly. But there are all these different methods of fishing. And primarily there's limited public access to salmon fishing. There has been traditionally, although depending on which country you're in. For example, there's reasonable public access to, and when I say public access, that doesn't mean that you can just walk up and fish. It means that you can at least get on at a not outrageous price. You don't have to lease the entire river for the next 25 years into your grandchildren in order to fish there. And there, for example, in Ireland, there's good access to the fishery, less in the case of some of the famous Scottish rivers. But so the access is different. And certainly, for example, you want to fish the Kola in Russia. That's another case altogether. But the access is a little different. The methods are slightly different, although certainly the emphasis is still on fly fishing.
So you said in Canada it is strictly fly fishing, no lures.
That's right.
No spin fishing. Oh wow, interesting. I didn't know
that's
that.
Fine. Well, let's take a brief break. But before we do, Paul, you mentioned one term. I may have misheard it. Did you say kelts?
Yeah, they're called. There's a number of terms. They're called black salmon. They're called, but the official term and the correct term is kelts. Those are fish. Now, kelts are not just Atlantic salmon. There are all kinds of different kelts. Trout. There are plenty of trout kelts as well. It's any fish that has spawned in freshwater and is going back out to the saltwater again.
Okay, great. Thanks for clearing that up. Well, let's take a brief break, and when we return, Paul will be answering more of your questions about fly fishing for Canada's Atlantic salmon.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers all across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Mariner about fly fishing for Atlantic salmon. If you'd like to send Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Paul your most important question. We'll receive your questions promptly, and we're answering as many of these great questions as we can on the show tonight. Paul, we have a number of questions about equipment. Mike Boutte in Quebec wonders not only the size of equipment, but what action do we want on our rod?
That really has to do with what you're comfortable with. There's no specific requirements in my mind for one type of rod action over another. Really, you're going to be fishing. You're going to make a lot of casts, and when you're fishing for Atlantic salmon, you're going to be throwing long lines a lot of the time. And so really what you want is a rod that you're most comfortable casting with for many hours and throwing, in some cases, as long a line as you can every single cast. So it's a little different than trout fishing. You definitely want to be you definitely want a comfortable rod.
We also have a question from John Wright in New Jersey about the reels and particularly the drag. He wonders about details of the drag that may be required.
I have, over the years, not paid a whole lot of attention to drag for when fishing Atlantic salmon. I grew up starting with reels that where you put the drag on yourself with your hand, and single action reels and rim control drag. And so I don't use, because of the fact that you have to reset the drag when each time, I tend to forget to reset the drag now, so I set the drag only strong enough to prevent overruns, and then I use my hand to apply the drag that I want. Other people do prefer to have an adjustable drag, and that's really a matter, once again, of your comfort level with the reel. However, you certainly don't need to have drag.
And Paul, you didn't mention what weight rod a person should have up there. What would you suggest there?
Well, the rods span the gamut, and probably one of the major differences, I was going to mention that some of you have been asking about changes, so let's say over the last 40 years or so. One of the biggest differences now is the reintroduction of the two-handed rod. And so people are using two-handed rods these days, so anywhere from, say, 8 to 10, 11 weights, all in an effort to improve coverage of the river and also to improve the ability to mend line and control the action of the fly at a distance. I would say that the most common weight of rod, line and rod is probably an 8 or 9 weight, 9 to 10 foot. 9.5 is a very popular length rod, and so I say traditionally a 9 weight for or 9.5 foot rod for a 9 weight is a good general rod to have. If you were fishing primarily for, say, dry fly for grouse, you might drop down to a 7 weight just to if you didn't expect to catch any very big fish, then there's certainly nothing wrong with going down to a 7 weight.
John Wright again from Morris Plains, New Jersey wants to know what kind of casting skills you need.
Well,
I guess he's talking about distance.
Yeah. Now, because you can fish so many different rivers when you're fishing Atlantic salmon, you can and different ways to do it. That is really not critical if you choose correctly where you're going to fish, how far you can cast. Mostly, it's can you cast consistently and lay out a line hundreds and hundreds of times to keep covering the water. If you choose to fish large water where you're going to wade, then you may want to be able to cast 70, 80 feet. But at the same time, you may be fishing from a canoe, for example, in which case you never have to cast any more than, say, 50 feet. And the same may be true on some smaller rivers where a 50-foot cast is going to cover the water. So everything depends on the type of water that you choose to fish and exactly how you're choosing to fish it.
What would you recommend for the newcomer to Atlantic salmon? Bernard, and our friend in Los Angeles, wonders, what would you recommend?
In what regard? You mean in terms of tackle?
Well, no. I'm sorry. Oh. What rivers? In other words, size, technical requirements, say, of the fisherman and that kind of thing for the newcomer. Is there a particular water that you would find would be recommended for somebody like that?
Well, I would certainly recommend that a first timer have a guide,
sure,
and go with an outfitter that offered guiding services, so that you get the instruction and you shorten the learning curve or flatten the learning curve a little better. No, I guess the other way around, isn't it? Steepen the learning curve, and so that's what I would recommend certainly for a beginner. I would think too that you might want to fish a smaller river rather than attempting to take on one of the larger rivers to begin with, but certainly I think the best advice is to go with an outfitter and in that way have a guide that will help show you how to cover the water and how to find out where the fish are, et cetera, et cetera.
Are there smaller rivers that have pretty good populations of fish that you'd recommend?
Well, within the Miramichi system, if you take the Miramichi system, for example, you can find rivers of virtually every size in the Miramichi system somewhere, and so I would highly recommend the Miramichi, mostly because of the fact that there are, like I say, so many opportunities. So something like the Dungarvan, which is part of the Miramichi system, is a small river, easily not intimidating whatsoever, and there are certainly opportunities to fish it. So if you go with an outfitter, you can ask about fishing, say, on the Dungarvon. But an outfitter will know also areas that you can fish. For example, you take a river, you can take a large river, and you can and somebody may have good spots to fish where only you're only fishing a little portion of the river, where it's braided or there are channels and this type of thing. So you don't happen to have to cover any large amount of water.
Sure.
Also, I want to mention that in Paul's book, Atlantic Salmon, he has charts in there for all the provinces up in Canada showing all the major rivers that are fished and what are the fishable lengths and the miles of public water. And I'm sure that you're updating this in your new version, but this would probably be a good source for people to find out about the different types of rivers and where they're at up there. So, Paul, what about lines? I know a lot of people use floating lines primarily, but can you talk about floating, intermediate, sinking, what you use, how you use them?
Sure. It once again, because it's a long season, I change around, and one of the things that I do in the spring when fishing for kelts, for example, I will use a sinking line from a boat, a full sinking line, and in order to get the fly down. But if I'm waiting in the spring for kelts, I'll use a sink tip. Then once the bright season arrives and the water warms up, there's no reason to use anything else effectively. 90% of the time, there's no reason to use anything else but a floating line. If you happen to arrive during a major flood or something, then you might want to go back to a sink tip to get the fly down a little deeper. Once the fall comes, however, the water cools down, and quite often there's a fair amount of water around. We do have hurricanes, and we hope for hurricanes to keep our water levels up. And you will probably want to get the fly down a little bit again, and I prefer now to use a variety of sink tips. Judging the weight of the tip on the depth of the water and the speed of the water that I'm going to fish. I don't want to scrape the bottom, but I do want to get the fly down, so I may use anything from a light one, like a 100 grain tip, and go up to, say, a 350 grain tip for the deepest and fastest water.
Are the fish leader shy? John Robertson in southwestern Ontario wants to know, and it's critical to use as long a leader as you can manage.
No, almost definitely not. The standard length of a leader is about rod length. You might, under low water, warm water conditions, go a little longer. But generally, salmon are not leader shy. You don't want to go really light, obviously, because you're big fish, and if you go light, you're just going to break fish off, which is not the name of the game. So I would say that if I was fishing a dry fly, for example, for grulls, for smaller fish, I would probably fish with nothing smaller than a 6 pound and probably an 8 pound. When I'm fishing larger fish, certainly with the larger lines, I'll be fishing 12 pound. An average would be, a lot of people would use 10, and then occasionally even I'd go up to 15 pound. So, the average length of the leader, as I said, is rod length.
All right. Why don't we move on to flies here, Don? I know a lot of people want to talk about that. Paul, many of the flies are quite beautiful, at least in the past. Those are the ones you see framed on the wall or beautiful color plates in books. Is it still that way, or have we moved on? Are we moving to more flies with less window dressing, per se? Or how has that fly evolved?
Okay, well, it moved on a long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah, starting probably in the 30s, maybe even prior to that. Although that was primarily the 30s and the 40s were the major development periods for the harrowing Atlantic salmon flies. And today, you will find one in a thousand salmon fishermen would be fishing with a classic feather wing fly. Virtually they're all hair wings. So that those classic flies are still tied, but they're tied primarily for exhibition. You may get a few angry listeners that come flying back and say they use nothing but classics, but believe me, if you try and buy, if you were to walk into the local gas station or some other place, or even most local fly shops on salmon rivers, you'd be hard pressed to buy a classic a feather-winged salmon fly.
Well, and I suppose if you wanted to buy them by the dozen, you want to make sure you take out a loan first. Huh?
That's for sure. Some of those classics sell for I don't buy a lot of them, so the prices change. But I think somewhere between $300 and $3,000 or something you can spend if you really want to spend the money on some of the classic Atlantic salmon flies.
Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me, does hook color matter? Almost all the plates you see, the photographic plates of the classic flies, at least, have black hooks. Why is that?
Well, that's more of a conditioning. Now, those are Japaned hooks, and the traditional salmon hook is a fairly heavy wire. It's a different size than what you're used to, say, with trout hooks. If you took a look at a size 8 salmon hook versus a size 8 trout hook, they don't look the same at all. So they have their own sort of sizing. And as well, that Japaned hook is just more or less traditional. There's no particular reason for it other than that. Of course, it helps with the longevity of the hook. The other thing is that many of the more modern hooks are tied on regular, what I would call regular bronze hooks. The very popular Bug series, for example, Green Machines and that sort of thing, are tied on Donai Mustad hooks or other hooks, bronze hooks, as well as most dry flies are tied on bronze hooks.
One of the changes that has been made, I know up in Montana when we were talking to Kelly Gallup about some of his streamer patterns for trout, is moving to a short-shanked hook following the lead of a lot of the saltwater flies for quicker, better hooking, less fouling kind of thing. Has any of that been explored with the salmon flies?
Yes. I would say, for example, my favorite flies to use in the fall are marabou flies. Those who are familiar with the popsicle series from the West Coast would know what I mean. They're wound marabou flies, but I tie them on plastic tubes. And so I use very short shank, heavy hooks, like for those familiar with West Coast fishing, particularly egg hooks. That's the type of hook I use, and I find those hook better, and they don't lever themselves out with the fish. So I'm using a streamer style fly, you would call it that, with a very short shank hook. But because it's tied on a plastic tube, my hook is still at the rear of the fly.
I think the short shank hooks also are less prone to be thrown because of different leverage points.
That's right.
And that's one attraction for the tube flies. When you're selecting a fly, Reuben Siegel in Melbourne, Australia, wants to know what's the important consideration? Is it size, color, what action you give it?
Well, one of the oldest arguments in Atlantic salmon fishing is whether salmon feed or not. And the answer is, I like an answer given by a Scottish biologist in the 19th century, where he said, salmon don't feed, but fortunately for you anglers, they do take food. And the answer, and that's really the best answer of them all. So salmon are not feeding in the river. And so what excites them to take the fly is an open question. And what excites them on one day doesn't excite them on the next. Otherwise, we'd all use the same flaws. As a result, I believe, anyway, and a lot of people would agree with me, that they take a fly because from memory, because they, as I mentioned earlier, the power is so aggressive. And so they take a lot of things, and they're willing to rise for a fly, very willing to rise for a fly. So when they come back as adults, they remember it, and when they see something swim by, they tend to grab it. Now, so what's the most important? If you were to go to the UK, they produce books, and they list for every degree or every 2 degrees change in water temperature, they change the size of the hook. Now, I'm not quite as rigid as that, but certainly that in terms of a general direction, that's quite correct. As the water warms, you tend to use smaller hooks, smaller flies, and in colder water, you'll use larger flies. Color, you tend to have drab flies generally. When you're using the smaller flies in the summertime and in the fall and in the early spring when you're fishing for kelts, you want brighter flies because they seem to react better to bright than to dull. So the answer is it depends on the time of year, it depends on the season, depends where you're fishing, but I would probably go first with size and then say 60% depending on size and 40% depends on color. But, I mean, that's just a guess, you know.
Well, gentlemen, it's time to take a little break again here. So when we return, we'll be answering more of your questions about fly fishing for these classic trophies.
Fly tires, are you looking for better thread control when you're tying up those number 20 parachute atoms or spinning deer hair? Are you breaking thread, tightening down on those big saltwater streamers? The Rite bobbin is your answer. That's R-I-T-E bobbin. It's the only adjustable thread tension bobbin on the market today. Just dial in the tension 1 ounce at a time and kiss broken thread goodbye. Professional fly tires worldwide are enjoying perfect thread control for all their patterns. For details, go to our website, www.RiteBobbins.com. That's R-I-T-E Bobbins.com. Rite Bobbins, sold at dealers worldwide.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Mariner about fly fishing for Atlantic salmon. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Paul your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Paul, a couple more questions about tying flies. Are there any new artificial materials that are being used, the artificial hair and so forth, that hasn't been used traditionally in the past?
Well, not. The flies for Atlantic salmon continually change, too. New patterns come along, and people continually experiment with new materials. There's not a huge change, but they keep new materials keep getting introduced and new patterns, developed. I wouldn't say there's been massive changes. It's not like one particular material suddenly jumps out. Most of the flies are still tied with squirrel tail or beer or as far as wings go. The hackles are very much the same as they've been for a long period of time. But certainly new body materials are used and some artificial wing materials. So the answer to that is yes, but the tried and true flies are you'll still find more of those in the average salmon fisher's box than you would some experimental pattern.
Okay. Now, I'm still a little puzzled about the feeding thing. The fish put food in their mouth out of memory. Aren't they feeding almost exclusively on small fish when they've returned from the ocean?
When they return, they don't feed.
Correct. I understand.
You're
that.
Thinking about what are they feeding on in the ocean?
Right.
Okay. In the ocean, they feed on shrimp and krill. They don't feed very much on small fish in the ocean at all.
Oh, okay.
No,
okay.
They're not. Crustaceans are their major food source.
So when we're fishing for Atlantic salmon using dry flies or wet flies, what are we attempting to imitate?
Nothing. You're really not attempting to imitate anything. If you looked at the favorite dry fly for salmon, it's called a bomber, and it's really just a deer hair clipped in a sort of ovoid shape,
right,
with a hackle wound through it, and it may or may not have white wings at one end or the other, and et cetera, et cetera. The point is that imitates nothing on the face of the earth. It's just a big thing that floats along, and if you spend much time on salmon rivers during your lifetime, and if you happen to indulge in that awful habit of smoking, and you flick a cigarette butt out, you never know. Salmon might come up and take the cigarette butt. They'll come up and rise for twigs and leaves and all kinds of things. So you're not really trying to imitate anything. You're just simply trying to trigger. What you're trying to do is trigger a response from somewhere in their memories to take a fly. Now, having said that, while it's a little rare, I've on several occasions during my salmon fishing career seen fish, salmon rising for dry flies just like a trout. Now, were they feeding? They just got into the habit and they would suddenly just sit there and continually rise and take a mayfly off the surface during a heavy hatch. But it usually takes a very heavy hatch to get them going. And in the days when we killed a lot of salmon, when you cleaned them, there was virtually never anything in their stomach at all.
Huh.
So they just don't feed in the rivers at all.
Okay, well, here's a part of my confusion. Jim Smith in Connecticut sends in, he's experienced, they catch broodstock hatchery salmon in early spring on their home waters, and they'll have a belly full of stonefly nymphs. Now, spring, so they're not spawning. But apparently Connecticut releases broodstock salmon in the fall. The question is, if we're going to be fishing them at a non-spawning time, what are we trying to do with our imitations there?
Oh, okay. Fair enough. When I mentioned earlier about kelts going,
yep,
coming down in the spring, when the kelts come down, they do feed, and what they'll feed on is anything they can find. But primarily, they meet in larger rivers. They'll meet a run of smelt coming in from the ocean that come in at about the same time they go out, and so they'll feed on smelt, and so that you will find. You can find all kinds of things in their stomach, depending on where you catch them on their way out of the river in that early springtime. But when they, and of course I couldn't really argue with anybody or debate with anybody about the nature of hatchery fish from, mm-hmm, taken out of a hatchery and put in the river. I don't know exactly how they would act. They've been,
right,
they've been fed as adults with on different things, and so I can't really say from experience how they would react. But certainly, for fish that are heading back to the ocean in the early spring, say in late April or early May, the spring season usually runs on the Miramichi, for example, from April 15th to May 15th, and during that period, particularly in the lower river, they will be feeding on the incoming smelt.
Well, real quick before we move on to presentation strategies, what would be your go-to wet fly?
Well, I anticipated that question, and
we always have it.
Yeah, I would put it to you this way: there's two flies. I carry a Casaboom in my wallet at all times, so I'm never without a Casaboom at any time, whether I'm on the river or not. I always have a Casaboom in case for some reason I didn't happen to have one in my box. So I always have a Casaboom. But at the same time, if you ask me, what fly would I never want to be without, and if I only had one fly, what would it be? It would be a green bud beer here.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about some presentation strategies. And I think you mentioned, and the term keeps coming up again and again, are lies, and that the fish are in their lies. And I've noticed that you've used that terminology you know, more extensively than other types of fishing. So can you describe to us, you know, what is a lie, what makes a good lie, that kind of thing?
It's completely different from trout fishing. Salmon do not have the classic feeding lie or home lie or any of these other things that we think about when we think about fishing for trout. What they attempt to do is find a place where they're comfortable holding in the current. And that can be, that will obviously depend upon the height of the water and sometimes the temperature of the water. So the lie, it really is, it's exactly that. There's nothing that particularly makes a good lie, although you'll virtually always find lies, salmon lying, associated with rocks of some kind or other. So they're looking for a current break, but that doesn't mean that they, for example, try to hold off or get into slack current. They want a particular speed of current. And they're not really afraid of movement on the bank. For example, if you walk along the bank and you can see salmon, they can see you, you can see them. They're not like a trout. They don't run away. They just stay where they are. Now, they can be spooked by overhead, for an example, an osprey or something may move them off their line. But they're not. They don't try to hide. They're not like a steelhead, for example, that wants to get in under a sweeper or a sea-run brook trout, which are definitely light shy. For example, they're going to be trying to hide under anything they can find. But the salmon don't. They're out in the open. You can, if the water's clear, certainly you can see them. And so that's what. The lie really is a speed of current. They'll find a place where the current speed is suits them.
Well, what's your presentation strategy then when you do spot a fish in a lie?
Generally, what you're trying to do is, because once again, what you're trying to do is trying to get the fish to take a fly from memory or trying to stir them up. So very often you don't want to just go and do what you do with a trout, try and cast a fly out and work it quickly in front of the face the first time around or work it by them. We often talk about setting up a salmon, so it can be much better to present the fly several times from above, moving down ever closer. And the presentation is to continually get that fly to sweep across the river in front of the fish, getting closer and closer all the time. In some ways, I've often fished that way from boats. You can think about hot-shotting for steelhead, for example, where you allow the lure to work in the current and slowly back your way down the pool. And for pushing that, getting that fly or lure or whatever you happen to be working with in terms of steelhead, working it in front of the fish to try and anger them to get them to take the fly and or the lure. And the same thing kind of works with salmon, except you don't, in most cases, you don't work it back like that, but you do that by casting across, letting the fly swim in front of the fish, and then moving down, coming ever closer to the fish.
So that's a cast down and across is what we're doing.
That's right.
Downstream and across. And is that what the term classic method refers to?
That's the generally accepted way of covering a pool. There are obviously other ways. That's certainly the way you cover it if you can't see fish. What you're trying to do, if you don't know precisely where they are, then, of course, you're trying to cover all the water, and that's the best way to cover the water. If you can see the fish, for example, if you can see the fish and fish dry fly, now you won't spend as much time trying to approach a fish with a dry fly in the same way. You're going to try a series of different dry fly methods. For example, the classic dead drift, you'll try that over the fish, but you may also try popping it down on top of the fish's head. You know what I mean by that, right above them, and just sort of dropping the fly on there and lifting it off quickly and just keep that up and then perhaps dead drift it down over the top of them again. So, remembering again, you're not trying to imitate food. You're trying to excite a take.
Do you actually sight fish for salmon, as we, you know, you said when you see fish, but mm-hmm. would you sight fish for a particular fish to bring that streamer right in front of them if you're wet fly fishing?
Yes, that's what you fish for particular fish. If the water conditions are such that you can see fish, you'll fish for a particular fish. And, you know, you wouldn't bother to continue past that fish. If you know that there's a fish in a particular place, then you'll fish down to it. And if it doesn't take the fly, you go back up and try again with another fly, or you can work it. Once you move down like that, you can work several flies in front of the fish without returning, for example, up and working down towards it again. You can change flies. And then, of course, you can change methods after that. There's other things to try once you... Once the fish ignores your fly the first time around.
Do you ever weight your flies or weight your leader, or do you allow the line to take the fly down to the fish?
You cannot weight flies in Canada. Weight is illegal in salmon flies. So you have to use, but you can use sinking leaders, and you can use sink tip lines. So you use the line and leader combination to get the fly down. Of course, at one point in time they used to use big irons when they didn't have good, for example, our modern sink tips. The one way to get the fly down in heavy water was to use a 10-aught hook, for example, or some huge hook, which was, of course, as heavy as if you were winding lead on it. But you won't see those on the river very much anymore.
And you don't weight the leader either?
No, you're not allowed to put weight on the leader either. You can use a manufactured weighted leader, but you can't put split shot on it, for example.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, do you give the fly any particular action as you're trying to excite the fish?
I really do, but some people believe in doing that. There are some people who believe that you know, a small amount of movement helps induce a take. That's really a personal thing. I don't do it, but other people do. I tend to do things like change my angle of approach. So, for example, I'll speed the fly up by casting more directly across. Occasionally, if the current is slow and I want to increase the speed of the fly, I don't like the speed that the fly is swimming, then I will activate it by slowly stripping it. Or activate it with the rod tip, depending on the situation. But in general, I don't activate the fly.
Okay. Do you ever put a riffle knot on a fly to try to create greater disturbance?
Yes, I do. I very much enjoy fishing riffle hitch flies. It's the one of the major reasons for that is that A, it's effective, but it provides a coverage method. For example, let's say you're fishing a pool that the water's dark and you can't see any fish, but you like to fish close, you know, you like to fish on top. You want to fish a dry fly, for example. Well, fishing a dry fly without being able to see fish is hard work, and I don't think it's very productive most of the time. That's not to say that people don't do it. They do, but I tend to want to fish dry flies for fish that I can see. Okay, so let's say I still like that surface take, that action on the top. The riffle hitch does that because the fish will take that on top, and so it allows me to cover my water the same way as I would with a wet fly, but get a dry fly strike.
Can you kind of describe to folks what the riffle hitch is and what it does?
Sure. What it effectively does is take the leader. You put a half hitch behind the head of the fly. You tie the fly on normally, then you take a half hitch behind the eye of the fly. Usually behind, you actually have to go behind the head. You take that half hitch, and so what happens is that when you cast it, the fly now is pulled against the current and swims across on top of the surface and cuts through the top of the surface. Well,
kind of surf sideways.
Yeah, it goes sideways. That's right.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, I have a question here from Clark Amadon in Vermont. He's wondering about the time of day. He's planning to be on the Margaree. Is that how you say it?
That's right.
okay, late September to mid-October, and he's wondering, should he be up at the crack of dawn and out early to be the first casting on a pool, or should he just ease into it by mid-morning?
The answer is variable, but let me try. At that time of year, I don't bother trying to get up at dawn. Definitely not. And the reason is that you can never be sure when the mood will strike salmon to take. And it can easily strike them at noon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Remember, once again, we're not dealing with a fish that's feeding. You're dealing with a fish that all you're trying to do is entice it to strike. And so as a result, quite often the eighth guy through the pool, maybe seven people gone through that pool before you in the morning, and you're the eighth person in, and the eighth person catches the fish. So the fact is I fish that river every year at about the same time, and I don't get up at the crack of dawn. Now, let me say something about the summertime. It's different. If you can be the first one on the pool during the, say, July and August and perhaps first part of September, if you're the first one on the pool, you have a better chance, I believe, anyway, to catch the fish because you don't enter the pool at all. You fish right at the top of the pool. And quite often there'll be a fish that's moved up. It hasn't left the pool yet. It's moved up, and so it's holding in that fast water, very shallow. If you put your foot in, you'll just push the fish out of that spot, and then you're no better off than anybody else. But if you're there first and you don't make the mistake of stepping in the water, you stay well back from the water and make those first casts way up, you've got a better, much better chance of catching a fish.
Well, Paul, we're about ready to run out of time here, but I do want you to address those busy seasons up there, and we all know that it can be busy in those easy-to-access rivers and so forth, and that there is certain ethics and etiquette that have evolved up in Canada for fishing. Can you briefly kind of go through that with us so that lower North Americans might behave ourselves up there?
Okay. I wanted to say one quick thing otherwise, and that is one of the biggest changes in salmon fishing in the last 40 years is increased access. In Quebec, for example, that used to be that it was all totally private, and you couldn't get on the rivers at all because they were leased by people with a lot of money. And they changed that, and so now there's actually a lot more salmon fishing available. Now, it's still not free, but you can get on it. There's a lot more salmon fishing available now than there was when I started salmon fishing. Okay, let's go to the etiquette. Quickly, the etiquette on public pools, that is where you're fishing with other people, is that you just use common sense. And if you work your way, you're supposed to rotate through the pool, which means if you're going through and you probably will if you're with other people, you're going to be using a wet fly approach, and you're going to be using the down and across. And you should take a cast and then a step. And cast and a step, work your way through the pool, and then the other people are working their way behind you and the guy ahead of you is moving. And so that way everybody gets a chance to work their way through the pool. And that you'll see signs on a lot of rivers that say, you know, rotation is required. You're expected to do that. And that's one thing that trout fishermen, for the first time, they just don't think about that. They don't think about, because it's just not a natural way to fish for trout to work, you know, 5 or 10 people through a pool. The ethics are because you're going to use large flies, you're going to use sink tip lines from time to time. The ethics are simply remember that you're not fishing for food. This is not a food fishery, it's a sport fishery. And there's no sport in foul hooking fish. So you choose wisely your equipment to give you a good chance to catch fish, but to catch them fair in the mouth, not to be hooking them in the back by and that has happened. There's people that do that, and that what that causes in the end is they change the regulations so that you and I can't fish properly anymore. We can't use the equipment to the best advantage. Even though we're ethically using our equipment, we're barred because other people are using it unethically.
Well, very good. So everyone from the U.S., behave yourselves when you go up there. And it is a mindset change because, you know, most trout fishermen will fish a hole and you know, stealthily, and that's much different than we're talking about here. So I appreciate your input on that. Well, we are out of time, and we have to move through our closing motions here. So when we return, we'll be giving away a copy of Paul's book, Stillwater Fly Fishing, Tools and Tactics. and a three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and also a one-year membership to Fly Fusion Magazine. So stay tuned and see if you win.
Attention fly fishers, are you aware of the proposed Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit could generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or the world for that matter. The well-being of Lake Iliamna and the entire Bristol Bay Area waters may be at stake. If you are not already, acquaint yourself with the concerns. You can make a difference, and the ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to sportsmansallianceforalaska.org. That's Sportsman's Alliance, the number 4AK.org. Sportsman's Alliance 4AK.org, to learn more about the issue, and you also have an opportunity to sign a petition to help stop this project. If you know of other conservation issues, please bring them to our attention at info@askaboutflyfishing.com. In the future, we may be running special editions on our website which deal with these topics. But get involved, be proactive, help protect our environment and the future of fly fishing. From the global events calendar, the 4th annual Caddis Festival banquet is being held on Saturday, May 5th, at the Chaffee County Fairgrounds in Poncha Springs, Colorado. That's just 5 miles from Salida and the famed Arkansas River. It's sponsored by the Collegiate Peaks Anglers Chapter of TU, and the festivities begin at 5 p.m. and include music, a buffet, auctions, and raffles. Here's your chance to celebrate the Arkansas River Caddis Hatch and help raise money for stream restoration, habitat improvement, and youth education. Go to the Global Events calendar. The link is near the bottom of each page on our website, and look under Colorado for more information. Fly shops and clubs, you can list all your fly fishing-related events on the Global Events calendar. It's free. You do it yourself. Go to the events calendar and get started. Get your events out there for everyone to see. Classes, demos, clinics, schools, shows, anything related to fly fishing. And we'll be highlighting one event from the calendar on each of our shows.
Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show. It says, what did you think of this show? Just click on it and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, last time to give away Paul's book, Stillwater Fly Fishing, Tools and Tactics, the membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and the Fly Fusion Magazine. Now, these winners tonight are drawn from our randomly drawn from our show's registration database. So if you didn't register now, it's a little bit too late, but be sure and register for the next show. You don't want to miss out on some of the incredible prizes that we do have to offer. Now, if you're the lucky winner tonight, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So here it goes. And first we'll draw for Paul's book. And I'm going to click the magic button here and see what we come up with. And Thomas Marks in New York. I think Thomas has won before.
Well, we hear a lot from Thomas. He's always good about sending in questions and that.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
So I
congratulations,
think,
Thomas.
It's a lucky man there. And let's go. So he'll be receiving Paul's book, and I'm sure he'll put that to good use. And now we're going to draw for the three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is also an excellent prize, and that would be Monty Smith in Oregon. Monty Smith in Oregon, so congratulations, Monty.
Great.
And then the last one is Fly Fusion Magazine, and that is produced in Calgary, also a Canadian product.
Mm-hmm.
And our winner there is Dale Shillington in Alaska. Dale Shillington. So we've got them all over the world here tonight.
Yeah, not bad. Well, congratulations, everyone. Paul, we really appreciate you being with us tonight. I've learned so much, not the least of which is how to pronounce Miramichi. But thanks very much for taking time to share your experience and knowledge about fly fishing for Atlantic salmon. With any luck, maybe we can convince you to join us again another time.
Enjoyed myself.
Well, great. We enjoyed you as well, Paul. Our next broadcast will be on May 23rd at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll be interviewing Jeff Currier. And our topic for the show will be Lake Nasser's Nile Perch. This is a exotic show for sure. Jeff's been with us before on the show, talked about European nymphing that last time. And I'd like you all to listen to this show because many people think this is an exotic trip that he's taken. But he assured me that he's doing it for less money than you can go to Alaska for. So it's not that exotic when you talk about the dollars spent. Jeff has just returned from Egypt, and this is his second adventure in search of the exotic Nile perch. And so join us and join Jeff to find out what it takes to figure out how to fish for a fish that's seldom caught on a fly. Well, we'd like to thank the R.L. Winston Rod Company, Mountain River Lanyards, Front Range Anglers, and Wright Bobbins for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.